Karen we're going to share with you tonight and stretch your mind just a little bit. I suppose in the last few months that nothing has captured your mind or mine more than the aspect and the prospect of free energy. And tonight we'll talk about it and the men that have made it possible on Open Mind. All right, you ready for that? There are a lot of people that are deeply involved around the world of making free energy a reality for you, for me, for everyone. And they're not only in the United States, but they're all over, and there's some here in the United States. But the ones that have come to our attention are members of our family, you and mine, here on Open Mind. You've talked to them many, many times, and tonight you'll get to talk to them again. Because it is here, it is online, it is free energy. And I'm very delighted to have in studio with me a man who has electrified you on many, many occasions over the past few years. I hate to use the term electrified as a pun, but he has. Mr. Tom Bearden, who is one of our outstanding theoretical physicists. His credentials are deep and extensive, deeply involved in America's weapons research and the development of America's weapons systems. Deeply involved in analyzing what the Soviets are doing in their weapon systems, and certainly deeply involved in science and physics and free energy. Tom, welcome to Open Mind tonight.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's glad to have you. I'm glad to have you right here in the studio. Usually it's on the phone, but you know, there,
right.
There you're sitting right there.
A little earlier here.
Yeah. Also, a young man that took theory and made it real. Made it a part of our world, made it work, and Angelino, like the rest of us, and brought forth, really, a free energy device that works, Mr. John C. Bedini. John, welcome aboard. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be here, Bill.
And with John is the other half of what I call the Technobrats. What Tom dreams up and John dreams up, this man has a way of making it into hardware, Mr. Steve Wirth. Steve, welcome to Open Mind tonight.
Hello, Bill. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also in the studio is Ike Mueller from NASA, who has done extensive work on John's machine. Ike, welcome aboard. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
And your work on John's machine, I think, was just incredible. You know, very thorough. You went through the whole thing. It stands right there.
Thank you.
Our subject tonight is free energy, and I want to go to Tom first, because, Tom, I know that this audience is very familiar with you. We hear talk about free energy. We hear about devices. We hear about schemes. We hear about perpetual motion machines. We hear about this and we hear about that. Are we really into the era now of having mastered the science of what we would call a free energy device?
We certainly have mastered the beginning of it, Bill. And certainly the Bedini device has point blank demonstrated that effect. Once again, we point out that when we talk about free energy, we're not talking about something esoteric. We're not talking about anything any different from putting a paddle wheel in a stream of water in a river. Nature furnishes the energy. If you can find the river and put the paddle wheel in there, you can get energy from that river and you can use it. And the only thing we're talking about is a little bit more subtle river and a little bit more subtle paddle wheel. But nonetheless, we're talking about exactly the same kind of process, finding some of nature's rivers, electrical rivers, and tapping them in an electrical device, and that's what John has done. And others, too, but, you know, particularly the John Bedini device, the one I'm talking about.
Well, it seems to be head and shoulders above the others. In the case of now, a couple of weeks ago, Joe Newman was a guest on the show, and I have an enormous respect for Joe Newman and his work, and particularly his fight with the bureaucrats and the courts in trying to get that patented. But in an appearance that we had at Town Hall earlier this week, I thought John stated it very well. Joe Newman's device develops an enormous amount of torque. John's device develops electricity. And therein is the difference.
That's correct. I believe Newman will get his patent. He's made a very strong case in the court. He's made a very strong case in demonstrating it, and I believe the patent will be granted. Now, after the last court hearing, I think there's been a very strong finding in his favor. I don't really see how the patent office can continue to deny the patent in the face of a device which actually does turn itself and does prove the principle. So I believe he will finally get the device. John's device, of course, is sitting there. It does run, as you and he both just recently demonstrated right here in Los Angeles. Device is real. It produces the power. At that demonstration, he had it producing 2,000 watts of power, 2 kilowatts. So that is sufficient to prove that for a breadboard device, which it is, it's just the first buildup of a device.
Right. And we were looking at a very crude and primitive device there.
We're talking about a practical machine. Excuse me. We're talking about a machine that can be brought from where it is right now into development. And clearly foreseeable what you've got to do to develop it. It can be scaled up to give more power. And the machine is a practical machine. That is, it's a running machine. It doesn't call for any drastic change in the state-of-the-art of building electrical machines. It's just an unusual set of fabrications and techniques you use rather than you've got to have something totally new, like, for example, building an atomic construction would be. So it's a very practical machine.
Well, the bottom line, you know, we talk about a free energy device. You know, I think perhaps we need to come up with a new kind of nomenclature for it. Because it isn't free. The energy isn't free in that sense. There is a lot of time and effort that was expended in developing and putting it together. There's going to be time in maintaining. But when we say free, you're not going to have to stick your paddle in a river in order to turn a generator. Or you're not going to have to burn oil or gas in order to fire a furnace that will build steam to turn a generator. The device itself is tapping the sea of energy that we live in all of the time and creating the energy that we want. Is that one way to put it?
That's a good way to put it. In the word free, we meant free for the taking. We did not mean that it's free of any type of cost whatsoever. To direct anything, even to capture sunlight, which is free for the taking, you've got to build some kind of device. You've got to build some kind of construction. It's going to take you time and effort and research money to develop that, and it's going to cost you some money to build it. The point is, after you build it, it's going to continue to take the energy from the sun. And this is that kind of device. It's just coming from a little bit different source.
Well, I remember 10 years ago, I put 10 solar panels on my roof to heat the swimming pool. I figured that using that system rather than heating my swimming pool electrically, which is what I would have had to do where I was living, it would have taken about 9 months to amortize heating the pool. But nevertheless, I did have to put out the money. But after it was done and after it was paid for, the rest of it was just maintenance. We're talking about now the technology for you to have a machine at your home about the size of, or maybe half the size of, the little thing outside whenever you have an air conditioning system that runs and gives you all of the energy you want, and you don't need any outside sources. All you have to do is buy that machine and maintain it. Am I correct?
That's correct. It'll take some maintenance. You know, you've got the oil bearings once in a while. any kind of device you build will have a mechanical breakdown once in a while. There will certainly occur from time to time an electrical breakdown in any kind of electrical machine, but the machine is of the type that those things are minimal. And so the machine in production, that is, once all the research costs for the final production set have been spent, in other words, your sunk costs are there, the machine can be made down the road after the tools and dies and all and this sort of thing can be made relatively cheaply. So we're not talking about something that in production is going to cost $10,000. We're talking about something that in production, if I had to give you a seat-of-the-pants estimate, I would say $1,000.
Or maybe less.
Depending on how big a unit you've got to have.
But for the average home?
For the average home, I would guess that the eventual production cost will be $1,000 or less.
To your right is Ike Mueller. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who he is? Because I want to ask him about his reflection on that machine. I know he spent a lot of time with it. Give us his background.
Well, Ike Mueller is an aerospace engineer. For some time, he represented the German effort with NASA in the space area. He is presently the U.S. representative for a German firm called the MIT Corporation.
Uh-huh.
Ikey has a very interested and varied background. He has looked at great numbers of devices, all kinds of machines. He's quite a production engineer, I might add. He's quite skilled at putting together technical projects, producing hardware that rolls out the end and rolls down the assembly line. That's his specialty. And he's also a good, very good man in electronics. He knows what he's doing in that field. So, yes, he's a good friend and a good engineer, and it's a pleasure to have him here with us.
Ikey, I want to get your reactions to the time that you've spent with John Bedini's free energy device in just a moment. We are talking free energy, and if anybody knows free energy, I think we have them right here in the studio to talk to you, and we'll get to all of them, and we'll get to you in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. You. We're talking about you having free access to all of the energy you need for anything that you want it for. We've been talking to Tom Bearden, one of the, I think, the nation's foremost theoretical physicist who has been talking to us about this for a long time. And Tom, I think that whenever you saw it finally come into fruition, that it finally happened, these things we were talking about, you must have been exhilarated that night.
It's like having a dream come true.
A dream came true. I want to talk to Ikey Mueller right now. Ikey has written a book about the Bedini device, a scientific paper, which is available through the Tesla Book Company. We'll tell you more about that in a little bit. But Ikey, you spent days with John. You went over that machine, tooth and toenail. Does it work? Are we really talking about free energy?
Well, it works better than I thought it would work.
You thought?
When I first measured the machine, I found many things which are not very common that they can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So when we loaded, for instance, down this machine, it turned out that the machine was running easier. This means it needed less energy. We measured this effect, and we found a very good relationship also. This means when we even shorted the output on this machine, the power intake of the machine was decreasing rapidly.
So it's working backwards from a normal electric...
Totally backwards, yeah.
Everything about it is backwards. What happens whenever you hook it up to your house? Is the house going to be backwards?
I don't hope so.
Well, in short, the more the machine is demanded of it to work and produce energy, the more it seems to like it. Is that it? It really goes to work.
Exactly.
And if you ask it not to work much, if you turn everything off in the house, it really starts cutting up on you. In fact, it wants to stall out.
Yeah,
you got to find something for it to do if you don't need it, right?
Exactly.
I suppose you can do that with all kinds of little relays and things like that.
I think that's state of the art, yeah.
It also, as we saw at Town Hall this week, it uses extremely little wires. The bigger the amount of electricity that it's producing, the smaller the wires seem to have to
be. That's
right. Why is that? Isn't that backwards? It should work the other way, it seems to me.
Well, you better ask Tom about the reasons what's behind. But see, I'm very practical. I want to get it working that everybody can use it.
Mm-hmm.
And in earlier times, I worked in space business, in space projects, because it was a new land. It was where you can put some new ideas to work. We work with not only ideas, but also with materials, for instance, in satellite business, which were not invented at the time when we worked with them. So we had to do something new. And here it's very similar. That's the reason that I now started to work in this alternate energy field, because it's a new land. And we know that it works, and we just have to put it together.
Well, that's the thing I want to keep impressing upon the minds of those people who are having trouble with this. We do have a machine that does tap the sea of energy in which we live, and it produces electricity. And you don't have to fire any other kind of fuel to make it work. It just works because the energy is there and it knows how to tap them. Is that one way of putting it? I know it's oversimplified, but that...
No, that's the way it does.
Is there anything else you want to add on to that before I get to the technobrats over there and get there?
Well, maybe later.
Okay. Sitting next to Ikey Mueller is the young man who thought and dreamed and had an idea. And by golly, he did it. Mr. John C. Bedini. John, welcome to Open Mind again.
Welcome, Bill.
Your little machine just hums right along, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of unusual, as I tried to explain to the people out there before, it was pretty hard to kind of see this from an engineering point of view. Generators don't speed up, Bill. They slow down. You know,
whenever you make them work, they start slowing down.
Right.
They're like you and I.
You go to the textbooks, and the first thing that you learn is you have to wind the coils a certain way. The magnets have to be a certain way. And the minute you connect the load, I think, not to jump the gun here, not to change the subject, I think everybody dreams of connecting a motor to a generator and then connecting the generator's output back to the motor. And somehow when they do that, the motor always stops.
It runs out of gas somewhere along the line.
Somewhere. You know, you just can't do it. The generator can never put out over what the motor is taking in.
Yours does, John.
Well, yeah, this one runs backwards because if there's 2,000 watts at the load, there's 2,000 watts inside the generator to keep it spinning, mm-hmm. you know, which is absolutely an impossibility under conventional theory. But, however, I am a firm believer that I've been taught wrong
mm-hmm.
by some strange means. I mean, why did I pay all this money to go to school, you know, through correspondence and everything else, to learn now, 11 years later, that it's not so? That the textbook, what's missing from the textbook? I mean, what are we going to get out of all this?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up, John, and it's something that we've talked about, certainly Tom and I have, for the last 3 years, that we have this this great thing out there called academia, and
right.
perhaps some of academia is listening to us tonight. The physicists that are working in the space industry at TRW and North American Rockwell and all of these great citadels of knowledge and physics, that what they're doing is wrong. It doesn't work. I was very intrigued with our presentation at Town Hall earlier this week, and we had some designers of the shuttle,
right.
and they looked at your machine, and they tested it,
yeah,
and fiddled with it, and played with it, and they finally said, how come we're spending so much money on fuel cells,
right.
taking up all of this time and payload and millions of dollars to develop these fuel cells whenever that little breadboard model that you were displaying, and that was a very crude device, would have done the job for them?
Yeah, you see, because one of them right after that demonstration came up to me and he says, why are we spending all this money on fuel tanks? He said, we really don't need any fuel tanks. If we just figure out how it's capturing the energy, we can just leave without the fuel tanks.
Well, you know? The ramifications of it
right.
are enormous.
Right.
One of the things I would like to throw up, there may be some people listening here who fancy themselves of being, and indeed are, very much physicists. They're very, very deeply involved in the world of physics that we have, you know, that is a part of the world we live in. And we're challenging you. You know, those things that you learned in school are wrong. And those things that you're working with every day are wrong. And if you don't think so, you've got some pretty good minds to toss that over with. And we have till midnight for you to go back and forth with Tom Bearden and Ike Mueller and John Bedini and you, that little fellow on your right over
yeah.
there who doesn't like to say too much, Steve Wirth. Steve, welcome aboard tonight. Steve has a way of listening to what Tom says and what John says and running off and hitting his computer and his machine. The next thing you know, he's coming out with his little part. I mean, he's a magician with that thing. What did you think, Steve, the first time that you were asked to make this little doodad or that little doodad? And I know you argue a lot about that because for some reason or another, you understand who Nikola Tesla was and who T. Henry Morey was and what their theory is all about. You guys just get together. We're going to... When those two get together, we're talking about an explosion.
Well, John, he comes up with these mad ideas, and we look at them. And I says, well, okay, let's give it a try. And we put it together, and then we fire them one up and check out and see where we made a mistake, if there is any, or we discover new ideas.
Blow up a couple
and,
batteries.
Yeah. Blow up a couple batteries or mess up a few wires here and there. And we're going through a large learning curve, and we've learned an awful lot in the last year. And John and I, we've got on the drawing board to build bigger ones, like a 10 kilowatt and then up to 50 kilowatt, and also up to 160 kilowatt generator.
Well, Steve, you're a very practical businessman. You're a In a business of a no-nonsense business, you've looked at this, you've played with this. Is that free energy device producing energy in your estimation?
Oh, yes. It's producing way more than I've ever seen. And even the price-wise, because give example, say the machine is 1,000 for 10 kilowatt. If I'm mistaken, if you went to buy one off a commercial shelf, we're talking around 4,000 or 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to put gas in it.
Yeah, but this one, you don't have to put gas in it.
No.
You don't have to put oil in it. You don't have to do anything. You just turn it on.
Turn it on.
But, Steve, you might add, you know, for the people out there, the many flops before the machine actually ran.
Right.
I mean, Bill, it's impossible to burn out number 18 wire and find that in the number 18 wire, there was just one little arc that took place. You know,
well, what is a number 18 wire? You got to look. You know, I'm just a radio guy. I'm not a physicist here.
Well, number 18 wire is about
60,000 diameter.
Yeah, it's we wound this stuff, me and Steve, on these armature poles, and of course, you know, we wanted to see the machine run. But when we fired the machine up, as Steve can tell you, how many coils did it burn out?
It fired. It burned out 8 at one time, and that takes a tremendous amount of voltage. Burn out that size coil wires.
But tell them, Steve, how big the burn mark was. It was about the size of the end of a little needle point.
Yeah, all through them.
Well, I've seen a few burn marks on both of you from time to time.
Bill was
you get too close to the machine.
What's very interesting on the machine is you light up like 2,000 watt light bulbs, and we're only using a diameter of wire of 10,000 diameter. Mm-hmm. That's very small diameter, and if you went to put that in a regular 110 wall plug the same way, it fried that wire before I even knew the light bulb was there.
Well, as we had in the demonstration this week at Town Hall, you were firing up about 2,000 watts of energy there with the light bulbs
load,
and
yeah,
the heater and the whole thing. You were using number 30 wire?
Well, what I was using as a load was 8 100 watt light bulbs.
Yeah.
In parallel, and also a 600 watt quartz glow heater down the center of the light bulbs.
Right.
And they were all in parallel with each other, which meant that the impedance of that circuit had to be around 1/10 of an ohm, just firing up. And I think you remember, Bill, that the quartz glow heater was way over the brilliancy of what that heater should have been.
Yeah, it was doing its number. But you were feeding that with this wire that's smaller than a hair.
Right, I was feeding it with number 32 wire.
Number 32?
Yeah, to be exact, that was number 32 wire. And we even called a person out of the audience and had him grab the wires.
Which should have burned up.
Right, should have burned up in his hands. And I told the people before I started the demonstration that if I took the load off the machine, why, the motor that was driving this thing would just stall off their wall current. And, you know, everybody says, well, there's no way you're going to stall that motor, John. If it turns the machine, it's going to run it. And sure enough, we took the wires off it, as you saw and Steve saw and everybody that was present there. As soon as that load was removed from that machine, well, I couldn't suck any more energy in, so quit. That was it.
That's right. It has to be working or it won't work.
That's right.
That's a strange thing about that.
It's a very unusual set of scientific circumstances that we're playing with here.
I hope that we have provoked your imagination just a little bit, and I want to give you some numbers where you want to talk to these people, because what they're doing is, if you read the physics books, is impossible. And I would suspect that if you call Caltech or UCLA or USC, their physics departments, or any of the high-tech industries we have in Los Angeles, which are many, and ask them if this could be done, they would tell you, no, it cannot be done. But the fact of the matter is that despite what they said, nobody checked with them, and it's being done. And if you have some questions about it, here's your chance. Let me give you the numbers. They all end in TALK, T-A-L-K. In Los Angeles, your prefix is 520-TALK, T-A-L-K, or 8255. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. In Orange County, 750. If you're in Glendale, Pasadena, or Burbank, your number is 244. If you're in the San Gabriel Valley, your number is 448. If you're down in the South Bay, that's Rolling Hills, Palos Verdes, Manhattan Beach, Hawthorne, Hermosa Beach, all along through there, El Segundo, 679. If you're in Long Beach, San Pedro, Paramount, that area, call us at 639, and let's talk free energy. Let's talk about the impossible actually being here. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Interferometry,
whatever is on your mind, and I think that Brian wants to talk about a little bit of all of that. Brian, welcome aboard.
How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing fine.
I enjoyed your speech the other day at the town hall.
Oh, were you there?
Yes, I was.
Did that work?
Oh, you bet it did. Blew me away.
Did it now?
Oh, you bet. I couldn't believe it. It was there, and I had read about it, but I couldn't believe I was seeing.
You saw the device?
Mm-hmm.
It works?
You bet.
You checked it out?
Yes. I put a meter on it, too.
You were the one to put a meter on it. You know, that's dangerous with those meters. Brian, what's your background?
Well, I'm a technician with a Southern California firm.
Uh-huh.
And I do field engineering, and I've been interested in this since I first heard about it.
Did you feel that you were going to find some snake oil there or somebody just playing games with you?
You know, I started to have doubts about it when I saw it there because I couldn't believe, like I said, what I was seeing.
It is a crude-looking little thing, isn't it?
But it works, and that's the best part about it. It is as advertised.
Thank you very much, Brian. You have some questions for... We've got them all here.
Well, I wanted to ask your panel of experts about scalar technology. Is scalar technology being used to detect the site of future earthquakes in Southern California? And if so, is there still going to be a Southern California here in 5 years? Whoever, John or Tom, whoever.
I don't have any. This is Tom. I don't have any knowledge of the use of scalar technology yet, except for Professor Sanchez and John Bedini.
Right.
I believe Beck has one scalar detector or more as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the people right now that are using scalar technology, or at least that are admitting they're using it. I believe there are lots of people that are experimenting with it.
Dr. Beck will be on the show.
Excuse me, I turned my mic on. Dr. Beck will be on the show on the 30th of March, by the way, so you can ask him also what he's doing with
right.
it. I think he wants to talk about that.
Right.
Okay.
Certainly, the scalar electromagnetics could be applied to that. And Brother John here has... I don't know if he wants me to say anything about those detectors or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, you can go ahead.
He's got some super detectors. I've just recently, just within the last few days, gotten one from him, which is a rather incredible device. It reaches so far down from the standpoint of normal electromagnetics... He's reaching down 160 or 200 dB down in the noise and pulling out intelligible signals. Now, before we say that's just noise, since it's in the noise, let me explain a little something that what's actually going on. What he's actually doing, the scalar, as you know, is two or more things which sum to a zero vector. But nothing made by man or nature or anything else is a perfect summation. If you can get fine enough in there, you can find that it's just a little bit off. There's a little residue that you can pick up. So what he's really doing is he's going way down below where anybody, as far as I know, has ever been with a detector, and he's picking up that little bit of variation in the actual fields and things that make up the scalar itself. He's picking up the wobble, so to speak, in the components. And he's bringing that out and looking at it, and it's there's some incredible things. For example, at my own home, I've found that there's a very steady and very directional 0.07 hertz wave, scalar wave, that is sitting there in just resonance in that area. I don't know if it's the whole earth or if it's just the area where my house sits or where it's Huntsville, Alabama. But there is a 0.07 hertz wave that's just as steady and regular as a clock, and it's directional. It's almost north and south. Maybe John would like a crack at that one.
Yes. Up in this area towards, let's go up towards the fault line a little bit more, towards the Sylmar area, where the last big quake took place. Up there, there is a 200 to 400 cycle resonant wave, which is longitudinal, that's building every day. And this wave is varying around. You see, if there's a real important thing to look at here, that all these little things that are generating minute bits of energy.
John, do you mind if I stop you for just a second? I want you to collect your thoughts,
okay,
because I have to collect a bunch of commercials.
Okay.
We have. And, Brian, would you hang on for just a second?
Sure will, Bill.
Well, Bill throws another scalar wave in your direction.
Okay.
That kind of helps pay for all of this. I'm Bill John, the world to talk about it with. Tom Bearden is here. Ike Mueller is here. John Bedini and Steve Wirth are here. And we were talking to Brian when we took a little break. Brian, we want to finish the conversation with you.
Okay.
All right. And we were in the middle of John talking to you about what's happening up on the fault line with the scalar waves.
Okay.
All right, Brian. So anyway, to get back to this, we have been reading these buildups longitudinally. Now, let me explain something to you. This tuner that we are building... You see, what us engineers consider noise is electronic noise. In other words, we always try to filter out the noise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, what is generating that noise is far below that, okay, and that is the scalar. But the important thing for you to understand, before you can read this, you have to convert it into some means in which you can display it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What that requires is taking the signal from the tuner after being completely filtered at minus 160 dB down. Now, that sounds like an incredible figure, doesn't it?
Yes, very much so.
It's not. It's nothing, okay? It's the limits of what most of the devices will go if you pick a good set, okay?
Right.
And what we do with that is we take it down and we read the shift in that. We bring it back up through a pulse width modulator. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. Because, see, the pulse width modulator is going to read longitudinally. It's going to change longitudinally. Do you
mm-hmm.
follow
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is bring that back to analog and put it on the scope.
Oh.
Okay?
Yes.
Then all the noise is filtered out. You follow me?
Yeah.
Then anything that comes through is going to look like musical wave notes. You follow me?
I see.
If you plucked a guitar... And that, and you watch the guitar, the musical note die out, you would see this shift in this pattern as the wave changed its phasing through its spectrum. You understand that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But now to sum this all up, there's something very important to remember, and I want Tom Bearden to answer this question about what's down below this noise.
Well, there are many things, John, that are down there, and Brian. Point out to you that a scalar wave, if you look at it from the aspect of ordinary electromagnetics, you're talking about things opposing themselves. Technically, it is a stress wave. It is not a force field wave consisting of only one E field and one B field that's changing.
Right.
It's a stress. The closest analogy we can give you is like the pressure in a gas, and the pressure is pulsating. Only now we have pulsating E fields and B fields that always sum to zero. This kind of a wave goes right straight through the electron shell around an atom. It goes down into the nucleus, and it interacts directly with a strong force that binds the nucleons together. Now, the nucleus itself, when it puts out waves, it puts out a great deal of scalar waves all the time. They go right through the electron shells, and they go on out and they interact with other nuclei. The entire universe, the nucleuses, the nuclei of all the atoms in the universe, are in constant and total scalar communication. And our instruments, which have been developed for the single force field electromagnetics that interacts with the electron shells, we've been going around looking at the electron shell stuff.
Yeah.
We have not looked at the great cosmic engines of the universe, which are really... coming out of the nucleus.
Hey, listen, guys, can I break it off here? Brian, we've spent a lot of time with you here. I know that you would like to probably talk to him all night long, but we're really, really short on time. I hope that helps you a lot, okay?
That does.
All right, now stay with us because we've got two more hours of this, all right? I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking free energy tonight on Open Mind.
Hi, this is Don Anderson.
For just a second, Chuck. We're going to break away real fast, but you want to talk about the vacuum of energy? Is that...
Well, right, the...
the sea, you know, that great sea that they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and to discuss the scalar technology having to do with that. Is there time for that?
Well, not before the news, but I wanted to get you on the line. We're going to take a break here in just a second, but you can sort of phrase your question. Our walking music is going to come in on top of us here in just a
okay,
second.
Okay, well, as Tom remembers...
In fact, there it is.
Okay, well... okay, I'll hold on.
All right, I want you to hold on, because we'll get into the sea of energy and how you tap that sea of energy and how it is being tapped and how that's going to change the whole world.
All right, sounds good.
Thank you for your question. We're going to take a break for news at 10 o'clock on Open Mind.
Do with this river of energy, if you take the statement that you made some time ago, Tom, about the Tesla coil, as he created this big energy, if the folks remember the big large coil with the ball on top and all these sparks flying off. But you made a very cogent statement in that when those sparks take place, the bets are all off, in that the potential energy stored before the spark takes place is the domain where things are really happening, and that modulating that area before the sparks cause the breakdown of what's happening. Is there some analogy to these really thin wires supposedly creating carrying kilowatts of energy, but in a reverse direction? Or is that some sort of, or could it be that while you're in this domain before the sparks break across, are you working in a negative time area kind of thing? If you can remember Wheeler's a statement attributed to Wheeler where he says time is nature's way of keeping things from happening all at once, are you working around in that area?
The answer is yes. Point out that the scalar wave from the normal viewpoint represents a zero vector. It does not, if it were a perfect wave, it would not move electrons at all. And that's how John puts it through the little bitty wire. He's actually putting a zero vector wave through there. And so the electrons in the wire, which have to move themselves to cause heating in the wire, the only disturbance in those electrons he has is the part of the wave that's not perfect. If it were a perfect wave, he wouldn't move one electron. And so it goes directly into the load, which is then nonlinear. It strips it back apart, and you get all kinds of energy there. That's the way that happens. Now, the negative time part, the vacuum itself is nothing in the world, but this kind of oppositions of fields. In classical electrodynamics, we already know that in little bitty, tiny increments of time, we have enormous surges of field changes. Well, you got one this way, you got one that way, and they're opposing each other in there, and that's scalar. So the vacuum really is a large scalar field. That's one way to put it. Another way to say it, it's just a large potential.
It's just potential energy, unmanifest energy, basically.
That's correct. It's just raw potential. But you can structure it. You can polarize it. You can set up waves down in it through the vacuum that stay down below the surface, so to speak, like a submarine. You can do all sorts of things in it. But when you put extra scalar waves in there, extra artificial potential, you're actually warping and twisting the space-time.
But how do you calculate something like that?
Well, it's fairly simple. You take the definition of the amplitude as being the sum of the absolute values of the amplitudes of all the waves opposing each other. Let me say that real quick. And that'll give you the amplitude of the scalar waves. Then as they vary and always stay summed to zero, the summation of the absolute values varies. That's it.
That's it.
Well, it's like saying if I have an E-field that goes positive and another E-field that goes negative.
Well, I understand. I see the arithmetic, but
yeah.
I'm just saying that these small wires are boggling my mind now. What is the purpose of the wires if they're really, really small? I mean, you're saying there were number 64 wire?
No, there were 32 wires.
Okay, but I'm saying if you reduce the diameter even further, it would carry more energy?
If the wave that he was making in the machine is not perfect, if the wave were perfect, if it were possible to make an absolutely perfect scalar wave, he could use a wire much finer than a human hair and still put as much energy as he wants through it in that form. It's energy locked against itself. It doesn't evidence as ordinary energy in that form.
Now, did these lamps create heat?
Yes, they do. The lamp, the scalar wave breaks apart into the components, and it turns back into ordinary energy. And so the lamp lights up. Electrons move. It gives off light, real energy.
It's not a fluorescing thing, you know, the other technology.
No, no, it's real energy that you can measure. You can see it radiating away. It's bright. It illuminates the room. It's real power.
Well, a friend of mine and I, Earl, out in the valley, we've been discussing this for 3 years or so, and we're ex-microwavers, you know.
Right.
And now we're down here talking about zero frequency.
No, zero vector. The frequency is not zero at all. For example,
you could pump these vectors at some audio rate then, or some other rate. These vectors can be moved around at, say, microwave frequencies again.
Sure, you can move them around at light frequencies, microwave frequencies, and by the way...
So that's how you would do this transmission thing. You would take two scalar waves or two sources and create a third dimension or a third point.
A scalar wave represents an oscillation of the curvature of space-time. In other words, from no curvature, you curve it positive and you curve it negative. That's what you're doing now.
About zero.
Now, that's a general relativistic wave. It is not a special relativistic wave. It's totally different from everything we've been using in the textbooks. By the way, you mentioned microwave. Professor Ramon Sanchez has just joined us, and Sanchez has done experiments in the microwave region with scalar waves, and he's done the crossed beams of the distance experiment to make energy at a distance, and he's also changed the potentials and extracted energy from a distance. He's done the experiments, so they do work.
That's still phenomenal.
All right, Chuck.
Chuck talks about reaching down into the noise.
The noise is, he's talking about the electron.
I understand synchronous detectors can be made to do things like reaching 60 dB below the noise. That's nothing new, but you're talking about using these scalar frequencies, 0.07 hertz, to lock onto some other energies or some other frequencies or information or whatever.
What you've got is a, let me see if I can address that. Energy.
Make it quick,
I'll have
guys.
To make it real quick, so grab
okay,
it real
I'll
quick.
Go up there.
Here it is. Energy itself is tied to the idea of doing work. It's work you haven't done yet. If you ever turn it loose, it'll do work and give it some resistance. Now, work is totally tied to the concept of one single force moving against a resisting mass, F.ds, that gives you dw.
Okay,
now, what we have here is literally not energy. It is each little vector that's opposing there and varying. It, if you could separate it by itself, it would have energy. But since they're all locked together, they do not have energy. In other words, the difference between pressure and the release of pressure in a single vector is what we're talking about. They are two entirely different things.
And the resultant effect of that are these waveforms that he's picking up.
That's right. A wave of pure potential. That's the best way to look at it.
At nearly zero frequency.
No, at any frequency you wish to make. Whatever you wish to make, and any combinations of them you wish to make. You can do Fourier transform, Fourier expansion, the whole thing.
I got my little app here that does those things. Thank you.
All right, Chuck. Thank you very much
thanks,
for your...
Thanks, Bill, and thanks for talking to you guys.
Good penetrating questions. And for those of you that are just joining us, it may sound like we're talking about something that is very, very scientific. You're absolutely correct. It is. But I want you to stay with us because they're trying to put it in a way that I can understand it. And I figure that if I can understand it, you can. But the bottom line is that basically we're talking about the fact that the technology is here. The machinery is online that is going to be able to give you all of the electrical energy you need. And it's not going to cost you anything other than buying the machine, which is going to be inexpensive when it finally... And it will be done shortly, and maintaining it. You can disconnect from the Department of Water and Power. That's what we're talking about. It is online. It is real. It is here. So it would behoove you to stay. It's not above your head, and you may want to find out about this, and you may well have some questions you want to ask about that. Let me quickly give you the numbers. In Los Angeles, the number is 520 or 8255. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. Orange County, it's 750. All the numbers end in talk, T-A-L-K. In Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena, it's 244. In the San Gabriel Valley, we're talking 448-TALK. In the South Bay area, 679-639 down in Long Beach, San Pedro, and Paramount. We want you to get in here and talk to us about free energy, and I have the world's leading experts on it with me right now, so this is your chance. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.